Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Let's dance. On second thought, let's watch one of the 20th century's most important dancer choreographers in action on the Salem College campus in Winston-Salem. It's a week-long residency and performance series by the Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company, free and open to the public. Amazing. Next, we've got a dynamic mother-daughter authoring team that'll knock your socks off with two great new books that already have the critics all abuzz. Penelope and Jennifer Niven will join me. Peter Karoff will be back at the keyboard next week, but today he enjoys another vacation day as we wrap things up with Theater All the Way. Festival Stage presents The Last Night of Ballyhoo, and Twin City Stage brings us Fiddler on the Roof, next on Triad Arts Weekend. Internationally renowned choreographer, dancer, theater director, and writer Bill T. Jones appears in practically every dance history book that's been printed in the past 20 years. He's received major honors from the MacArthur Genius Award to Kennedy Center honors, and his ventures into Broadway resulted in two Tony Awards for Best Choreography. Next week, from Election Day forward, the Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company will be in residence at Salem College, working with Salem dance students on campus in Winston-Salem. It's part of the new June Porter Johnson series for the visual and performing arts. On Friday night, November 9th at 7:30, the company will perform a program of duets in the intimate and formal setting of Haynes Auditorium in the Elberson Fine Arts Center. It'll be followed by an audience Q&A and reception. On Saturday at 4:30 in Haynes, there'll be a screening of the PBS American Masters documentary A Good Man, which chronicles Jones's intense creative journey as he takes on the most challenging work of his career. On Saturday night at 7:30, Jones returns to Haynes Auditorium for his talk, Insights on Directing, Choreography, and an Artistic Life. All of these events are free and open to the public, and you'll find links to more at wfdd.org/triadarts. The Bill T. Jones Performance Series represents a dream come true for Salem College Associate Professor and Director of Dance Heidi Eccles. She's an accomplished dancer herself, having performed in New York and D.C., and she considers Jones as one of her most important mentors. Last week, Heidi and I sat down to talk about what this residency and performance series will mean to her, her students, and the Triad community. In a separate interview last week, I spoke with Bill T. Jones by cell phone from his hotel in Paris.
I saw him as an undergrad. I saw a video. I wasn't fortunate enough to see a performance, but I saw a video. I studied about him. I think that the impact for me was twofold. One was the notion of who could dance, who has the capability to dance. And when you looked at his company several years ago, even still today, the body shapes, the color of skin, the gender, everyone was diverse. And for me, coming from a pretty homogenous ballet training, that was an eye-opener as a young dancer to think that everyone's body is capable of moving. And here is a man who has gathered this diverse group of people and created this intense experience. I also then studied Uncle Tom's Cabin, one of his works, and was also very moved by the way he could explore a sensitive topic of race. And he was able to explore his personal experience. And I think that's when art is at its best, when you explore what's personal to you, but in a way that allows the audience to also connect and to have their own resonance with their own experiences. So that really moved me as a young dancer. I was able to then see him at the American Dance Festival. I've seen him perform at many different places and am just thrilled to have him come to Salem and work with students and perform. Yeah. And I'll tell you, I'm actually a little nervous to have lunch with him.
Well, he is,
you know, you
an
sit in front
man.
Of this mentor, yeah. You know, what has been your mentor, and you think, gosh, what will we talk about at lunch?
It could be intimidating, I guess, but he's also someone with lots of interests, and I bet you could talk about anything and really
absolutely.
Get into it.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Take us back to his early beginnings in school, meeting Arnie Zane, and then their studies with Lois Welk and his approach to this issue of stressing physical interdependence in dance. For the non-dancer, non-choreographer,
right.
How did that filter its way into both of their works and then really kind of inform their dance choreography moving forward?
for me, you can take it globally and look at how interdependent we are on one another. And so coming to see his work, then you see a fraction of that on stage, of the vulnerability when we're willing to depend on someone else and what that means. And then the growth that you can experience from that. So I'm always moved by his work when I see the sort of that vulnerable, humble experience that another human has when they are willing to give to another human being. And so every one of his works has that notion of giving up something to gain, and both individuals gaining by the giving up, by the letting go, if you will.
The duets that you began with Arnie Zane, I've spoken to a few dancers, and just they're speaking to how influential that early work has been in their lives. I'm wondering if you could describe for listeners, here's the magic of radio, some of the traits or characteristics that you all were hoping to get at early on in that collaboration that have really withstood the test of time.
I think part of it was that it was incredibly intellectual. The spatial patterns where you start with one simple little circle, and then there's a line that extends from upstage down stage, and there's an area over to the right that has benches. There's an area to the left, which is a circle of light. I mention this because this is the way we thought of it. We were drawing in space. So we were going through a kind of itinerary, a kind of steeplechase, if you will, of motifs that happened in particular areas of the stage that made it very brainy and very formal. The only difference was that Arnie Zane and I were not traditional dancers. Arnie was, as you know, 5'4", Italian-American. I'm a 6'1", African-American. Neither one of us had what you call ballet technique. And we employed everything that we had learned from contact improvisation, a very egalitarian, actually revolutionary form of partnering that through the use of leverage and counterbalance, you could have a very small person lifting a very large person. We used improvisation, we used a lot of freezes, and these things would actually repeat so that 15 minutes worth of material through repetitions and accumulation could become a 45-minute ballet. That was the aesthetic. You were watching us be ourselves, but you were watching us go through this rigorous kind of puzzle of repetition and accumulation. Yes, I think that's probably a way to talk about what our values were. We were very extremely visual. Arnie Zane was a photographer, as you know. And by the same token, it was something like no one had ever seen, because you could tell there was an intimacy between us, but we were very odd together. But there was a great camaraderie, and these duets were really tightly made with sandlot gymnastics, if you will. Standing on shoulders, flipping, rolling, like Deborah Jowett, the writer at the New York Times, described us as big cats involved in some sort of a urban social ritual. I'm butchering the quote, but you get an idea of what it was like. And there was speaking. I'm, because of my background as an actor and being the child of two African-American gifted storytellers, my mother and father, I was always doing abstract movement in my solo work or with Arnie, some abstract movement that it would be accompanied by some tale of my childhood or something I remember or something I read in a paper. And that was a hallmark of it. It was at once extremely formal and intellectual, but there was a lot of extreme confession going on and whispering and making up things, saying things improvisationally that made the performances very exciting and unlike anything you could see at that time.
Hmm. Today, here, now this is years later, how you see your role in this 21st century choreography in terms of the artist and what kind of change can be excited through the work, either social or political?
Well, one of the first solos I ever made did an innocent thing, which was just to tell a story. But the story, because of how it was told, was a story that starts off talking about receiving a little white card in the mail, and then I list my social security number when I was 12 years old. I then go back to the place I was born, which was in Bunnell, Florida, and I am confronted with my two aunts, my mother's sisters, Aunt Maddie and Aunt Purity Rogers, and they say something to me, which was completely shocking. They said, Billy, you ain't going to do like your brother Irie did. He went up north and married a white girl. Because if you marry a white girl, you can't come down here and visit us no more. That white card in the mail, the Social Security card, which is about a kind of anonymous organization socially, and then this kind of being suddenly defined as a black man with the limitations, those things fell on the ears of someone who was thinking they were completely free. So I was made this dance that day, which incidentally was called Everybody Works, was done in New York, got a lot of attention, and it was very poetic, but it was also, people said it was political, and I didn't understand what was political about it. I was just reporting my experience. That, I think, also happened when Arnie Zane and I began to perform internationally. Here we are, the short Jewish-Italian guy and this taller black guy dancing together, doing what we thought was an avant-garde form of partnering. Yes, with some words and free association, but when we went to Germany, they gave us the German Critics Award for a searing portrayal of the tension between whites and blacks in America. Aha! So no matter what we think we're doing, there is something about the eyes of the audience that is going to put us in a social political context. That has been a realization that was very important and remains important to me today, so much so that I try less to talk overtly about political ideas, knowing that they will be immediately contextualized as such. Uncle Tom's Cabin, yes. When Arnie Zane was in his hospital bed dying, he and I were thinking about our next work, and we were going probably every 2 years to the Next Wave Festival at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and we were wondering what we were going to do. We were hoping that he would get better, which he did not, but we were playing with the idea of an image, something which for us would be like grand opera, where we would employ the talents of a wonderful black soprano, Jessie Norman, and she would become Eliza from Uncle Tom's Cabin, and we would have her suspended on a styrofoam ice floe over the stage at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It was very, like Robert Wilson, it was very much a pie-in-the-sky idea, but he died. And I was left with the title, Last Supper at Uncle Tom's Cabin, featuring 52 Handsome Nudes, and because at that time there was a Jesse Helms problem going on, and there was all this concern about nudity, we changed that title to The Promised Land. Now that he was no longer there, it suddenly became my piece. And I used Uncle Tom's Cabin as a way to, quote, move away from the anonymity or neutrality of the avant-garde to try to find what I call the black voice in my way. And that work then became a whole meditation on difference. Something he and I had made quite apparent in our life together as a man, and also definitely in our company, which was always multiracial and multiethnic. But suddenly it became the topic, trying to understand the other, trying to understand what liberation truly meant, trying to rehear Martin Luther King. All of this was now Bill alone rather than Bill and Arnie. Following Uncle Tom's Cabin, as you know, ended with a stage full of every color of person, young, old, black, white, gay, straight, male, female, all naked and singing like children, bathed in a golden light. This was my idea of the promised land, or, quote, the utopia that the U.S. offered, that we do not have to be afraid of each other. Now, of course, it was ironic because there was such rancor, as we still see in our political system today, and this rancor had a cultural face with the likes of Mr. Helms and all decrying work that was somehow anti-Christian, anti-family values. Suddenly, what was a romp from the downtown art scene suddenly became a threat to the established order, and my work became a target for persons who were trying to understand what was wrong or what was right with our social discourse. Not of my doing, but it was what the time needed, and so I became a point of focus in that. Still here, of course, came out of that last image of Uncle Tom's Cabin, a stage full of 52 people, all naked, standing together. But we have a change now that everybody on that stage is no longer allowed to share blood. They're no longer allowed to share body fluids because of the epidemic of AIDS at that time. I didn't set out to make a work that was going to be about AIDS. I set out to make a work that was going to be about the human mortality. Once again, looking for a inclusive statement built on difference. Many people got hung up in the fact that this work was supposed to make them feel bad about sick people. That was never the case. That was supposed to have been a work that was primarily a dance work. Literally, it had beautiful dancing in it, but it also had the testimonies and some shapes by people who had lived and were living with life-threatening illness. My politics are like my face. I cannot get away from my attitudes and my feelings, not to mention my race and so on. So I just thought I would make the most beautiful works I could. We made works completely to chamber music. We did all those things. Then I was asked to do a commission for the Ravinia Festival on the 200th anniversary of the birth of Abraham Lincoln. I could do anything I wanted. So I tried my hand at making a big public spectacle, complete with the story of Honest Abe. But it would be also peppered with a kind of robust, physicalized, rolling, tumbling dancing that Arnie Zane and I used to do, but now performed by an entirely new group of people, some of them the age old enough to be my children, and with much more virtuosic technique than he and I had. There was also going to be a live band. There was. We had a Clarissa Cincino. He's a fantastic classically trained singer who is a jazz singer and an opera singer. The music is done by kind of East Village rock and roll kind of guys, Chris Lancaster. We were really trying to mix it up in terms of the different cultural reference points and in terms of historical and ethnic racial reference points, saying that this was, in fact, the legacy of Abraham Lincoln's vision for America.
I really enjoyed the PBS special covering A Good Man, the creative process and how the real-time nature of the work's evolution, how it morphed from what seemed like toward the end there, a day-to-day. One big one came after you're hearing the sound of a train. Would you tell me about your, at that point, are you feeling fear? Are you channeling anxiety? What's going through your mind when you suddenly are pivoting at that level, close to a deadline of that, you know, significance?
Well, yes, that's to the credit of the filmmakers. Now, you realize a documentary is only a portrait of subject, not necessarily the subject. But so, yeah, they made it very dramatic. It was dramatic. But, you know, that thing with the train was actually, it's actually one of the glorious, mysterious parts of creation. Just when you don't know what is missing, suddenly something comes into your subconscious or your conscious mind that was like standing there the whole time and slapped you in the face. I think it was a joy. As you could probably see, I was very happy when I heard it. Something, a connection was made.
Students at Salem College will get a chance to see this man in process and be a part of the process, which is just what an amazing opportunity.
It is. The company members will work with two groups of students, each comprised of dancers, musicians, creative writers, and actors. So we have this multidisciplinary group of students that are going to, in 8 hours, go through a process of generating a work. So the students know this will be intense, but they're absolutely committed and ready to go through this experience.
Wow.
It's a fulfillment of a dream that I've wanted to give to Salem College and to this community and really to the students. They will carry this for the rest of their life, no matter where they go or what they do. If they become a bank teller or, you know, an artist, they'll have this experience.
I say this to young dancers. A lot of art making is about responding. A lot of art making is about staying alert, open, listening. This is invaluable. You cannot sit down and write out everything that's going to happen and then go do it. I think you propose something, and then there is something else that gets counterproposed, and then an accident happens that is better than anything you thought of. But are you really fleet enough? You know, I'm an old athlete, so I understand what it means to be back on your heels or forward on your toes. You've got to be forward on your toes so you can go in any direction. But just trying to bring the thing in, bring it in whatever form it chooses to be in. That's all we can do. That's why I say it's a spiritual activity. It's not science. It's not politics. It's not mathematics. It's something more mysterious than that. It's called art making.
We heard Salem College Associate Professor and Director of Dance Heidi Eccles and world-renowned dancer-choreographer Bill T. Jones spoke with me by cell phone from his hotel in Paris. The Bill T. Jones Arnie Zaid Dance Company will be in residence at Salem College, working with Salem dance students on campus in Winston-Salem starting November 7th. It's part of the new June Porter Johnson series for the visual and performing arts. On Friday night, November 9th at 7:30, the company will perform a program of duets titled Between Us, a Studio Showing. It'll be in Haynes Auditorium in the Elberson Fine Arts Center and followed immediately by an audience Q&A and reception. On Saturday afternoon at 4:30 in Haynes, there'll be a screening of the PBS American Masters documentary A Good Man. It chronicles Jones's intense creative journey as he takes on the most challenging work of his career, Fondly Do We Hope, Fervently Do We Pray. Saturday night at 7:30, Jones returns to Haynes Auditorium for his talk, Insights on Directing, Choreography, and an Artistic Life. Thanks to the June Porter Johnson series for the visual and performing arts, all of these events are free and open to the public. The performance series continues in April with legendary performance artist Laurie Anderson. Then you'll find links to the complete schedule on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford. This is Triad Arts Weekend, and we're going to take a short break now. We'll return with Penny and Jennifer Niven. The mother-daughter authors each have new books out, and Bookmarks is bringing them together for a book launch celebration you won't soon forget. And on the second half of the show, we're off to the theater with a last night of Ballyhoo and A Fiddler on the Roof, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and you know, achieving high levels of success as a published author is extremely rare, but having two award-winning authors in the same family is almost unheard of. On Saturday, November 3rd at 7 o'clock in the Porter B. Byram Welcome Center Auditorium on the campus of Wake Forest University, you can meet two of them. It's a Bookmarks book launch celebration featuring the dynamic mother-daughter writers duo of Penelope and Jennifer Niven. Wake Forest alumna and Winston-Salem resident Penelope Niven is the author of Carl Sandburg, a biography, Steichen, a biography, and her new book, Thornton Wilder, A Life, has just been published by HarperCollins. Penny's daughter, Jennifer, calls Los Angeles home, and her books include nonfiction works like The Ice Master and Ada Blackjack, as well as the Velvet Jean novel series. The third book in the series, Becoming Clementine, was published in September, and the fourth Velvet Jean novel will be released in the fall of 2013. On Saturday night, Jennifer and her mother will read from their new books and autograph copies. Penny recently stopped by WFDD, and Jennifer joined us by phone from her home in Los Angeles. Penny, I'll start with you. I mean, just your entree into this world of literature and writing, where did it begin, and where did you first grasp the pen and put it to paper yourself?
I knew when I was 5 years old that I wanted to be a writer. However, my career as a professional writer began about 40 years later. That coincided with my discovery of Carl Sandburg at his wonderful house up in Flat Rock, North Carolina. So, of course, I had, I think, the natural, inevitable fear that you're going to try this thing and it may not work. You may not be able to do what you've dreamed of doing since you were 5 years old. At the same time, I met the woman who had been Sandburg's literary agent in the last decade of his life. And she's the person who said to me, you should write this book. And she said, every biographer has had to write a first biography. And I couldn't argue with that. And that gave me the boost I needed to dive in and do that. So Jennifer grew up with my fledgling work as a biographer.
And Jennifer, just glancing through your website, this was something that's been with you for many, many years. Talk about that early beginning and how it blossomed.
Mom, she instilled writing time into our daily routine when we could, when I was little. And it was just wonderful because she would work at her grown-up desk and I would work at my little one and I would you know, write my stories with such enthusiasm and energy. And I was very prolific, I have to say. You know, by the time I was 10, I had written volumes of stories and books that I'd illustrated myself. But, you know, it's interesting because my mom and my dad as well had always encouraged me to be whatever I wanted to be, to do whatever I wanted to do. Writing was always, you know, the first and foremost to me. But at the same time, I did see mom working. I saw how wonderfully fulfilling at the same time, how stressful it could be and all the work that went into it. So I witnessed that firsthand. And even though writing was my love, there was a period of time when I tried to do anything other than write because I saw how difficult it was. Mm. You know, and I'm really grateful for that because when I finally decided to, you know, pursue it, I had this great expectation and understanding of what it was like. So I didn't go into it thinking, oh, this is going to be easy.
We have, I think, very similar approaches to doing research. We are both immensely thorough. We love to do the research. We love to travel together to do the mm-hmm. research whenever we possibly can. We're both fanatical, if I may say so, about documenting everything we say and do in our nonfiction work. So we have that great connection in terms of that particular genre. Jennifer has written now 4 wonderful novels. So if I have in any way been a tutor to Jennifer with the nonfiction strategies, she has been my teacher in terms of the fiction, so much so that I'd love to try my hand at a novel.
Speaking of the Velveteen series, when you set up a series of expectations with your first book, does it put added pressure on you as a writer?
I write first and foremost for the character in terms of just trying to honor where she would go organically, naturally. I knew, you know, with where I started Velveteen Learns to Drive, the first one, I knew that she would eventually have war service. And in Velveteen Learns to Fly, the second book, she becomes a wasp because war breaks out and she learns how to fly and she wants to be part of this organization. And then it was only natural for the third one, you know, it is 1944, which is where the second book leaves off, and her brother has gone missing, Johnny Clay, and Velveteen and her brother are very close. And it's just the kind of thing Velveteen would have done to, you know, convince them to let her fly this bomber across the ocean, and then once she gets there, convince them to let her co-pilot an operation into France, which, of course, from then on, nothing goes the way it's planned. The new book, Velveteen Goes to Hollywood, in 1945 through 1949. The movie moguls had all this, you know, immense power. The East Coast Mafia had moved out here and were running all the nightclubs. And the gangster squad had formed a secret kind of undercover police unit that went out to take care of the East Coast Mafia. And Central Avenue downtown was just buzzing with Miles Davis and Charlie Parker, like new jazz musicians who were creating this whole new form of music. And it was just a very dynamic, exciting time period. And it was also just having it set here in Los Angeles.
Extend that a little further. When you're writing a biography, especially when you're entering the world of academe, and in this case, the Thornton Wilder scholars, what a Renaissance man this person was. I just blew me away. You can't believe that he's been involved in so many different endeavors in his lifetime.
And this is an American writer who has been so immensely well-known and virtually misunderstood and, I think, underestimated. This is the first biography of Wilder in 30 years, and it's the first biography to have access to just the avalanche of Wilder papers and records, and he left journals, and he left letters and unpublished manuscripts, so we can hear him speak in his own voice.
The name of our town is Grover's Corners, New Hampshire. It's just across the line from Massachusetts. First, we'll show you a day in our town, as it used to be in the year 1901. All right, operator, let's start.
We're coming up on the 75th anniversary of our town. Mm-hmm. a play that most Americans know and a play that's produced someplace in this world every single day of the year. And so it's great to see the man behind our town, bring him out into the spotlight.
Having that sort of access is incredible. How that inner life finds its way into some of the themes that he explored in his Pulitzer Prize-winning works early on, mm-hmm. the characters, the point of everyone deserves equal respect or treatment regardless of accomplishment. That sort of theme comes back in some of his earlier works. Could you explain how that voice finds its way from his life into his work?
He believed, along with Chekhov and other writers, that a writer's responsibility is not to give his reader answers to the big and smaller questions in life, but to ask the questions. And he started doing this. You see it in his journals and letters. He started doing this as a 12, 13-year-old and did it until the end of his life. He was on this personal quest to understand the mysteries of life and the wonders of life and the challenges of life. And so he expresses this in his published work, in his plays, in his novels. He says several times in his private writings that because he wants to express autobiographical experiences and themes, he writes fiction and he writes drama. He doesn't write memoir. He doesn't write an autobiography. So there's that interplay of the life he's living and the life he's writing. That's one of the fascinating things about this whole book. Who came along in his life, and then to find that event and that person cropping up in our town and the matchmaker and the eighth day and all of his work. It's just richly autobiographical. His name is Thornton Niven Wilder. So when I first read Our Town, when I was 16 years old and in high school back over in Waxhaw, North Carolina, I thought, Niven, I wonder if we're related. We are. We have a common grandfather, 7 generations back for me, 6 generations back for Thornton. His name was Malcolm McNiven. Lived on the little island of Islay off the west coast of Scotland. So we're planning an expedition to a joint expedition.
I'll bet you are. Islay, yeah. Jennifer will be along for that one.
She
Oh, yes.
Anything about the man, the writer that you garnered from this that you will use in future work?
Yes, yes. In fact, Sandburg was a biographer, and he wrote wonderful things about strategy and logistics and methodology, which I incorporated into the 3 books that followed. Mm-hmm. I learned from Steichen, the photographer, you need to try to get to the essence of a person in just an instant if you possibly can. And then James Earl Jones taught me that sometimes there's a difference between what is your emotional truth and what is the literal fact of your life. And then Wilder says so many wonderful things about writing that I'm actually working on a little book called Wilder on Writing.
You all get to share these stories and memories and creations with us right here in the Piedmont Triad. Set the scene for us. Will there be book reading, signings? What sort of back and forth are you hoping for, Penny?
We will have a program which begins at 7 o'clock. Jennifer will speak about Becoming Clementine and read. I'll speak and read from Thornton Wilder, A Life. Tappan Wilder, Thornton Wilder's nephew, and his literary executor will be here, and he will be speaking. And wonderful, beautiful Rosemary Harris, who lives here in Winston-Salem, will be reading from Wilder's work. She'll be reading some excerpts from the novels and the plays. There'll be a reception afterward with some special music and a book signing. And Jennifer and I are hoping to see lots and lots of relatives and friends and strangers who will become friends.
That was award-winning author Penelope Niven and her award-winning daughter, author Jennifer Niven. This Saturday night, November 3rd at 7 o'clock in the Porter B. Byram Welcome Center Auditorium in Winston-Salem, you can meet both Nivens during Bookmark's Book Launch Celebration on the campus of Wake Forest University. Penny's new book is Thornton Wilder, A Life, and it's just been published by HarperCollins. Jennifer's new book is the 3rd in her Velveteen series of novels. It's called Becoming Clementine. It was published in September. And the 4th Velveteen novel will be released in the fall of 2013. Velveteen finds herself in Hollywood in the 1940s during the heyday of film. You'll find links to more on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And this is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we'll take another short break now, and then it's time for The Great White Way with Tony Award-winning shows The Last Night of Ballyhoo and Fiddler on the Roof, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Nothing like a warm-hearted comedy just in time for the holidays, and Festival Stage of Winston-Salem has you covered with its season number 3 opener, The Last Night of Ballyhoo, the Tony Award-winning Pulitzer Prize-nominated play by Alfred Uhry, the man who brought us Driving Miss Daisy. It runs through November 4th at Haynes Brands Theater in Winston-Salem, and you'll find links to ticket information at wfdd.org/triadarts. The Last Night of Ballyhoo takes place in Atlanta, Georgia in 1939 and tells the story of an extended Jewish family as they prepare for Ballyhoo, the social event of the season amidst the worsening European conflict and the premiere of Gone with the Wind. The family of eccentrics grapple with discrimination and acceptance, the past and present, and they'll have you laughing and crying at the same time. Festival Stage director and Davidson College Theater Department faculty Anne Marie Costa and Festival Stage actor Rebecca Kuhn, who plays Boo, drop by to talk about the play.
Of a
is set in 1939, which is important in two ways. It's the premiere of Gone with the Wind. It's also the beginning of Hitler invading Poland. And what makes the play really great for this particular audience, I think, of Winston-Salem area, is it's set in the South, so you have all these Southern characters. You have this Freytag family and the Levies. And they're a family that is, help me out here.
A Jewish culture that's trying to effectively be assimilated into the Christian neighborhoods of Atlanta. So Judaism as a faith is not high profile in the homes of our Jewish family, but they learn in the course of the play some of the power and beauty of that religion and the universality of a holiday season.
So they have a Christmas tree in the window to be Christian, and then they try to hide their Judaism, and in the plot enters Joe, this wonderful guy from New York, and he falls in love with Reba's daughter, one of the aunt's daughters, and he brings his Judaism that he completely embraces.
How does Joe's arrival, how does he impact the families? What kind of impact do they feel with this person and his faith?
Adolf thinks there's no one finer as a human being and a man, and he would be very happy for his niece, Sonny, to spend more time with him, and she does. My daughter is attracted to anything in pants. So she tries for him first, and he disses her, which frustrates me because I already think he's inferior because he is the Orthodox Jews as opposed to the German Jews. Yeah. There's a lot of that prejudice.
Within the society of Judaism, yes, there's that conflict, and as there is in Israel
and
today.
And it's very real.
It does take it on to some extent. Yeah.
And to bring around to our title, Ballyhoo is a dance at the Jewish country club, the standard or the progressive, depending on whether you were the other kind or German Jews, and neither of which the Christians attended, nor could our children go to the Christian country clubs. And all of that is brought out in dialogue.
I'd be remiss without asking Rebecca to give us an insider's look at your character.
Well, Boo is a frustrated woman, having lost a husband who was not particularly impressive in his accomplishments and relegated to living with her brother and having a daughter who is pretty much a misfit, has come home prematurely from college, not embraced by her peers. And so I'm worried about her future. Ultimately, there is a turn for the better, but I'm kind of a sourpuss most of the time.
One of the other things she is, which is from the audience's standpoint, is she's very funny, as Rebecca can do so well, right? So because she wants to try to control her daughter, and she often fails horribly at this.
She talks about her daughter was the cutest little baby there ever was. She had so many birthday party invitations in nursery school, I ran out of ideas for presents to give. And then, the first week of kindergarten, she comes down with the red measles. The very first week. And, of course, by the time she was ready to go back to school, all the popular children had formed their attachments. And no matter how she tried or I tried for her, she was never able to catch up. I tried for her. You know, these hovering parents.
helicopter moms of the 30s.
Yes. Yes.
Festival stage director and Davidson College Theater Department faculty Anne Marie Costa and actor Rebecca Kuhn. The Last Night of Ballyhoo by Alfred Uhry, the man who gave us Driving Miss Daisy, has been called one of the best American plays of recent decades, and it kicks off the third exciting season of Festival Stage of Winston-Salem, running through November 4th at Haynes Brands Theater in Winston-Salem. You'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org.
Trade them.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's time to get up and stretch out those legs because we're just about ready to head back into the theater for another matinee this afternoon. This time we'll travel from a Jewish community in Atlanta to another Jewish community in a land far, far away.
If I were a rich man, all day long I'd be. If I were a wealthy man.
Fiddler on the Roof opened in 1964 and was the longest-running Broadway musical for nearly 10 years. The musical, with music by Jerry Bock, lyrics by Sheldon Harnick, and book by Joseph Stein, is set in Tsarist Russia in 1905. Tevye is the father of five daughters, and the play centers around his struggles to maintain his family and Jewish religious traditions in the face of imposing outside influences. Twin City Stage brings Fiddler on the Roof to the Triad beginning tonight, November 2nd, and running through the 18th. You'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org/triadarts. Fiddler won 9 Tony Awards, and it enjoyed more than 3,000 performances on Broadway. Twin City director Bobby Bodford and music director Margaret Gallagher dropped by to explain why. They were joined by TCS actors Mary Lee Williams, who plays Tevye's eldest daughter, Zeidel, and Michelle Gronick, who plays Yenta, the matchmaker.
If I were a rich man,
Bobby, we've talked before about this aspect of taking on a big war horse. Everyone knows Fiddler on the Roof. Is it intimidating starting off on something where you know everyone in the audience is going to be singing along with every tune?
No, I think that's an advantage because I want people to get engaged in it. Yes, it has a Jewish background, but the themes are for everybody. That's why it's one of the most popular musicals of all times. These people live a very bleak life, but their hope and their faith gets them through.
Yeah.
And everybody has to deal with that. It's pretty bleak for a lot of people right now. So stay positive, keep your faith, keep working hard, look for the good. That's what these people do. They come together as a community, and that's kind of their protection. It makes them very warm, you know, and close, and that's very important to them. And then on the other side, traditions are being broken by new generations. And that's a very difficult thing for Tevye. So we watch a father. Any father can identify with this. Your children aren't the same children anymore one morning when you wake up.
The times they are changing.
The times they are changing. And it has to be. We have to change. We have to evolve. We have to grow. Because we all are still experiencing these things over and over. It's everything you want a musical comedy to be. You get the comedy and it makes you laugh. And then it just turns around and makes you cry when you do Fiddler on the Roof. Tevye talks directly to God. You know, there's a lot of humor in that. There's wonderful scenes where everything freezes and it's just Tevye and his thought process on the stage together, which we as an audience are let in. Separation anxiety from a parent when your children leave you. I think Far From the Home I Love, the song that Huddle sings when she sang goodbye to her father, is one of the most beautiful moments in the theater. Tevye is saying goodbye to a daughter that's going to Siberia and he's going to America. They probably will never see each other again.
Oh, what a melancholy choice this is. Wanting home, wanting him. Closing my heart to every hope but his. Leaving the home I love. Where my heart is settled long ago, I must
the struggle that she represents when she sings those lyrics. I used to be comfortable here. Now I know my home is somewhere else. All children go through that. It touches your heart.
Papa, God alone knows when we shall see each other again.
Then we will leave it in his hands.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a fine, catch me a catch. Night after night in the dark I'm alone, so find me a match of my own.
Michelle, just the role of matchmakers around the turn of the last century in the Jewish community.
She helped the families make good unions because they didn't make their own choices. For Yenta, it is a paid profession. And she just walked around and looked, and that one goes with that one, and that one goes with that one, and let me see what kind of wheeler dealer. I guess they're kind of like car salesmen to me, at least in the reference of Fiddler on the Roof.
And you're talking about Yenta.
Yenta is old, and she's a lonely widow, and she gets joy from connecting other people together. It's a way for her to be out of the house. She's visiting with the community, and she's a busybody anyway. What a great job for a gossip, right?
Yenta, you said you had news for me.
Children, they are your blessing in your old age. It's about Laser Wolf the Butcher. A good man, a fine man, and I don't have to tell you he's well off, no? Yes. He's cast his eye on Zeitel.
Such a match for my Zeitel.
I think but she's high-spirited and truly loves what she's doing. She doesn't really realize that she's sort of obnoxious and
bit of a talker.
Right. She's one of these women that just likes to talk and talk and talk. And, you know, God forbid she should ever stop talking.
Was picking up the Yiddish difficult for you? The accent, I should say.
I kind of listen to people's cadences when they talk. And so to me, I think it's kind of easy. If you really listen to pick up dialects,
it's very melodic. It strikes
me. The cadence and vowels and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Look at. And Zeitel, you're the oldest daughter, correct?
I am.
Okay. I love the family tension dynamic throughout this, but ultimately, you're the first to kind of stand up to Dad. Tell me about your battle for love.
Well, Zeitel is in love with Model, who is a boy that she grew up with. And they gave each other a pledge, apparently, about a year before this play takes place. And they really, really want to get married. And Zeitel wants Model to ask her father for her hand. And he's very shy. He doesn't like to be yelled at. And Tevye, Zeitel's father, yells a lot. And so he's really intimidated by Tevye. So he wants to save up all this money to get a new sewing machine so he can impress her father before he asks for her hand. And she says, you know, this is going to be too late. It's going to be too late because the matchmaker's trying to make us a match. And sure enough, Yenta comes over and tries to match her up with somebody who is a lot older than she is, who she doesn't really want to be married to. So she and Model have to figure out, how are we going to get out of this? How are we going to get Tevye to let us be married and to break this agreement he's made with Yenta and the butcher, who she's paired him up with?
But ultimately, it's Model shows a little spine.
He does.
Oh, doesn't anyone have to ask a father anymore?
I've wanted to ask you for some time, Reb Tevye. But first, I wanted to save up enough of my own sewing machine so I would
you
have...
Stop talking nonsense. You are just a poor tailor.
That's true, Reb Tevye, but even a poor tailor is entitled to some happiness. I promise you, Reb Tevye, your daughter will not starve.
Huh. He's beginning to talk like a man.
What are the challenges in directing the musical of this
school? Well, anytime you direct a musical, you know, it's bigger because there's music and there's choreography. Even though there's more involved, the musical director, when you work with someone who knows what they're doing, like Maggie, she does her part. And the choreographer, Benji Starcher, he does his part. Then I take my part of the blocking, the scenes, and I do that. And then my job is to put it all together and make sure it all is headed in the same direction. But I'm not by myself like I am with a straight play. I have two other professionals, two other artists that are making their contributions. So it's actually a little more fun.
Gotcha. Maggie, well, you've been in this business for a long time. Where does it rank in your mind?
It's absolutely one of my favorites. The music is stunningly beautiful. There's comedy in the music. It has all the emotions, and the format is not as complicated as, say, a Sondheim show. The harmonies are beautiful, easy to accomplish, so that you can spend time working on the emotion that goes into that song. And every song is full of emotion. There's the humorous song Rumor that Yenta does.
Remember Perchik, that crazy student? Remember at the wedding when Seidel married Mottl and Perchik started dancing with Tevye's daughter Huddle? Well, I just learned that Perchik's been arrested in Kiev.
No.
Yes.
Shame. Shame. Wait till I tell you. Remember Perchik, that crazy student? Remember.
It's one of the more intricate songs in the show, and it's absolutely delightful when you see this rumor starting out here and ending up there, so far removed from where it really was.
May the Lord protect and defend you.
Sabbath Prayer, to me, is just one of the most gorgeous pieces of music ever. You've got a nice solo line with Tevye and Golda. You have beautiful harmonies that come in behind it. Then you have all these families spread out on the stage with their candles, with the mothers saying the blessing over the candle, bringing the light to the family. It touches your heart.
May the Lord protect and defend.
May the Lord protect and defend.
May the Lord preserve you from pain.
May the Lord preserve you from pain.
Tevka, when the people are saying goodbye and leaving and say, it's just a place. But they sing this song that just totally tears you apart inside. And you hear in their voices that heartbreak of having to say goodbye to each other and move on to a place they don't know.
Well, Anatevka hasn't exactly been the Garden of Eden.
That's true.
After all, what have we got here?
A little bit of this, a little bit of that.
A pot.
A pan.
A broom.
A hat.
Someone should have set a match to this place years ago.
A bench. A tree. What's a house?
Or a stove.
People who pass through on the Tevka don't even know they've been here. A stick of wood.
A piece of cloth.
What do we leave? Nothing much. Only our Tevka.
When everybody is leaving at the Exodus in the end, and this happened to any of those villages at that time in Tsarist Russia, they were forced to live on small parts of land anyway, but they could be evicted at any time. And so ultimately, in our play, at Anatevka, the villagers are evicted. Well, they have to take everything they have and leave in 3 days. Where are they going to go? Well, they all go different places. And it's a very sad thing at the end to see them all say goodbye. It's sad, but it's warm, too, to know the love that's happening and how touched they all are by each other and how they've been affected by each other. I'll tell you what's interesting about it, too, because it's from, like, 1963, I think. Musicals are different now. Okay, in those days, and I don't want to date myself here, but in those days, it was more straightforward. You have a scene, and then you have a song. And then you have a scene, and then you have a song. Very little underscoring, and that could have been due to the fact that I'm not sure how things were mic'd in the 60s, and maybe it was difficult to have dialogue come over the top of underscoring. But there is actually scene change music in this, because they finish the scene and then there's a little bit of change. The music would reflect the mood of the scene you've just seen, or it would set you up for the next scene, or both in mm-hmm. some cases. So it's very straightforward in that respect. There's nothing complicated at trying to figure it out, as opposed to a new show like Legally Blonde, where it's like one big giant musical number. Mm. Fiddler is just the essence of what musical comedy should be. That's why it's timeless. It will always work. I promise you can do Fiddler 20 years from now, and it'll still have the same effect on people as it does today.
Twin City Stage director Bobby Bodford and music director Margaret Gallagher. They were joined in the studio by TCS actors Mary Lee Williams, who plays Tevye's eldest daughter, Seidel, and Michelle Gronick, who plays Yenta, the matchmaker. Their production of Fiddler on the Roof opens tonight at Twin City Stage in Winston-Salem, and it'll run through the 18th. You'll find links to ticket information and more on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts.
Is there a canopy?
Well, that's all for today's show. World-renowned dancers, best-selling authors, and Tony Award-winning plays, all going on at the same time here in the Triad. How to keep track of it all, you may well ask. Well, for starters, you'll find podcasts of this show on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And be sure and join me weekday mornings at 8:35 and weeknights at 5:44 for Triad Arts. Our senior producer is Catherine Mobley, and our audio engineer is Eddie Garcia. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.